Okay, I'm here with Derek DeKirchhoff again, continuing our discussion. And we're in the Foucault section of the New York School of Media Ecology. Foucault was published by Sauveur Latrange through the Cimatext books, and a lot of French theory was made available to North Americans through the Cimatext series. So in light of what's happened in the last 24 hours there in France, Derek is not in Rome today, he's in Nice, and we have the tragedy, the assassination of 153 people or so. We're going to keep that in mind as we discuss this. So looking at the next paragraph that I wrote, it says, like McLuhan, and I have in brackets, see bottom half of page 31 in Marshall McLuhan's Counterblast, came out in 1969. So like McLuhan, Foucault sees this episteme as a cultural unconscious in quotes. And then the sentence from Foucault, continuing from the book Foucault Live, pages 39 to 40, Foucault says, very schematically, it consists of trying to discover in the history of science and the history of human knowledge, then he has in French, des connaissances et du savoir humain, something that would be like its unconscious, dot, dot, dot. These laws and determinations are what I've tried to bring to light. I have tried to unearth an autonomous domain that would be the unconscious of science, the unconscious of knowledge, in brackets, savoir, that would have its own laws, just as the individual human unconscious has its own laws and determinations. I think McLuhan wrote that sentence. It's so close. It's interesting. What some ideas you have right now on that, Derek?
No, the first idea is what the other day when we were first talking about Foucault, I remember that the cultural unconscious was a very powerful concept and I like the way that he sort of distinguished it from Freudian or Jungian.
Yes,
which is very well thought. But I think what he means, what I feel about what Marshall said in the age of instant information, we wear all mankind as our skin, which I think is one of his deepest thoughts and one of the most beautiful, in fact. Mm-hmm. I just really felt that today. And it's not so much, I'll get to the unconscious part that you'd like to see connected, but basically that's kind of a very strong, I feel like we all have an armor that protects us from these sort of things, but we don't have it anymore now that it's in real time.
Right.
So that what happened, you know, it's 100, as far as I know, it's not 173, it's 127 people that were killed. But they always count bodies. They always count dead people. They don't talk about the thousands more that have actually been hit by the various explosions and by the also the shots that didn't kill them.
Right.
I mean, there was this guy in this nightclub which started shooting quite calmly, randomly, and he was killing these people. I felt terrible when I saw about the single shooter who killed 87 or 83 Britons who were in Tunisia. I really felt terrible. But then I just suddenly realized that there is some unconscious feeling in the background, which normally we call stress, and that stress we associate with stuff that happened to us personally.
Mm.
But there is also a background stress that just keeps going, getting stronger and stronger, and in a place like Europe right now, even the prospect of having not being undercover anywhere, and I mean, you can't run anywhere and say,
right,
no, this is not going to happen. It's not going to happen here. So that background stress, which actually is coming to the foreground as the fear sets in, that's what terrorism is all about.
Yeah.
That background stress is made of all kinds of, you know, rivulets of anxiety, even including evidently the fate of the planet and the global warming. I mean, we now know that we've lost a fair bit of Groenland's ice. It's never happened before.
Mm.
So it's they all deny it. No, these things happen all the time. No, they don't happen all the time. They're happening now. And so I'm just feeling that there was a time when stress was associated only with oneself,
yes,
and one's problems. And that's not the case anymore.
No. The discarnate
and that's
stress.
Very McLuhan-y, I think, but, I mean, you know, it's also, I don't know, it's a very strong feeling.
Okay, so you're having this feeling. What if you were the president of France right now? What would you do? How would you
very
react
glad
to
I'm
this?
Not.
What?
I'm saying I'm very glad I am not the president of France. In fact, the president of France did react, and reacted in a way that you would have used for a theater play. It was just ridiculous. He said, we will seek the culprit, and we will be totally unforgiving. The word in French was, nous serons impitoyables, without pity. That's right. We will be without mercy and without pity. What a ridiculous thing to say. And you know, God. I don't know. I just felt
you're glad you're not here.
Inappropriate world.
You're what? Glad you're not him, but you're criticizing how he reacted.
Oh, he's like a fool.
Well, what? Well, like you're feeling
fool.
Like a fool. You're feeling vulnerable. Why can't he be given that slack? I mean, he's probably shocked.
No. It's let him do what. Let him say and do what he wants. There is no problem with that. But hang on, I want to photograph. I am in front of the sea, and there's the most beautiful sunset you can imagine, so I can't miss that.
Yeah.
You know where I am. You've been here.
Yes.
So,
are you going to go to your balcony?
I am on my balcony.
Oh, you're out. That's nice.
Hang on. Why is this not opening? Oh, yeah, I know. It's no problem. If it's locked, it can't open. All right, so you see what I'm saying? It has been a very difficult kind of...
Well, when did you arrive in Nice? Like a few hours before they closed the borders?
Yes. I arrived at 10 o'clock. No, at 9:45. But I had not, I was in a plane before. So I had no way of reading the news or dealing with any of that.
And you're talking about 10
o'clock?
So
I found that while it was happening.
Right. So that's 10 o'clock in the evening or in the morning?
Yeah, between 9:30 and 10 o'clock in the evening.
Right, so Friday evening. And
yep.
And then you get off the plane, and it is happening while you're getting home, taking the cab or driving
yep.
home. What
yep.
did you,
no, I wasn't driving. I was pushing my little wheeler.
Uh-huh.
You know that silly suitcase, that suitcase that rolls?
Yes.
That carries you that I have?
Yes.
Well, I was pushing that. Anyway, so no, and the news were coming like one after the other, and then there were... The first news was that only 18 people had been killed. Well, you'd say only, that's enough.
Yeah.
But then as the time went on, but they were... And the thing is, they were trying to control the problem in one place, and mostly at the stadium where the football game was going, but then it was really going on. I mean, this shooter killed these 70 people right then and there. And that was the next news.
Yeah.
But that came about half an hour later. So it was like real time following, not on video, but on by text. Text it was. I didn't put on the radio. But even the text was fast enough.
Yes. So if we look at this, I mean, remember, Understanding Media comes out right after the Kennedy assassination, so that was an intense time. So if someone's hearing it on radio or watching TV, is there a different perception than getting on the text? Is that even relevant anymore to think that way? Is your reaction due to you getting by text?
No, I don't. No. Although... Well, no, but I tried. I saw the video too. You can just spot it yourself. You can see that video just talks about there's this guy who made a montage of the video he had taken, and it starts like, you know, what's going on?
Yeah.
And it's really well done. And so, yes, I saw that too, and I know Paris. So, you know, I could find myself in there, and... It was really
well. What was happening in the street as you were coming home? Were people aware of it? Were they walking around? Were they stopping, looking at TVs in the stores?
Well, when I was coming home, no. I know that I crossed yesterday a cafe, but it seemed as if nobody in the cafe knew, because when I crossed the cafe, as I said, it was 9:30. I mean, the news started then, and I think nobody knew.
Right.
But Nice is not very... The really strange thing is was walking around in Nice today.
Oh, yeah. Okay, what was happening?
No animation in the streets, nothing. Mind you, it's... I mean, for a Saturday, you'd think, you know, that it'd be jammed with people, which usually is. Doesn't matter what time of the year. And they would all be, you know, screaming, yelling, and being pleased. There's no way. The only time I can remember the same feeling about how Nice felt was when they lost, when it was 2 or 3 years ago, when the French lost the finale to the Italians. Because they had won. Not us. Let me just tell you this, because this is a city feeling. So 2 days before, the French had won against the Germans? I can't remember. They won against Spain, probably. Anyway, who cares?
Yeah.
But they won again. And I was in Nice already, and the streets was jammed with people screaming, yelling, cars going down. Just like it does in Toronto, in fact, when they win, but more so in Nice. And then the day, 2 days later, when they lost, you could hear a pin drop.
Wow. Nobody on the street?
Anywhere.
Wow.
Yeah. And the other experience I had of that, you know, the noisiest city I think that I have been into, apart from New Delhi, is Naples, right?
Yeah.
Naples is really, really noisy. Well, when Naples lost to the Koreans way back, was it like 2004, 2005?
Yeah.
You could not even hear dogs barking.
But you're saying that there was nobody in the streets. Everybody was hiding.
Oh, there was there were people in the streets, but there was no animation.
Right.
There were not that many people in
no
the streets.
No communication.
There were less than
people.
Usual.
Nobody was
but,
talking.
But that restaurant that I told you that I crossed by, which was an outside place and it was nice and warm, it was jammed with people. Jammed with people.
Mm.
And I think it was just before the news broke out, because it was like normal. Hey, I'm in Nice, and this is how Nice is. Well, no. And then after that, things just really changed.
Okay, so but I'm not getting how it's changed. There's still people walking around, and they're not talking
to
each other.
From where I am, I can't see anybody. But it had changed where people, instead of having throngs, for example, La Place du Pain is it's just very close to where, and I was there. La Place du Pain, there's always a truckload of people sort of hanging on there. It's the place to be. Well, I actually saw La Place du Pain deserted today.
Wow.
Deserted?
Yeah.
I've never seen it deserted. So, yes.
Is that
yes,
place?
That
place where I walked along the boardwalk, you know, down the hill from where you live? Is that that beach area? Is that what you're talking about? Is that
no, no, no. La Place du Pain is actually... let's say it became somehow adopted by the gay community of Paris, and a lot of them, and now of course more international. But it's definitely a gay community area, so there's a lot of and a mixed couple too. I mean, it's not as if it's just gays, but they made it fashionable. As gays have money, they can actually buy places and get together, and then they can help restaurants and. So I think that's what happened. Anyway, that's cool. It's a very nice place. And as I said, it's very animated, but not this time. Not this time.
So
anyway, we can go back. I just wanted to record the fact that we're in a situation where at the conscious level now, between the unconscious background of the stress and the conscious level of our own sort of knowledge of how we feel physically or emotionally about whatever it is that we're into, the background is coming to the foreground.
Mm. So that makes everybody
which
quiet?
Which is monster. That's what McLuhan used to say. If you put the
figure
foreground
and
the background.
Figure and ground merge.
If you merge
becomes
them,
a monster.
You make a monster.
The law
That's
of
right.
a theorialization. It's a theorialization. Mm-hmm. You know,
oh,
he added that to the tetrad. You know, that was on the first page he handed out. I was talking to somebody about when did he start talking about the tetrads publicly, and it was in 1974 he had that little leaflet out, little Xerox, and he has the figure ground becoming a monster as one of the tetrads on that first time he released. He had something to give out to the public. Do you remember that piece
mm-hmm.
of paper? I think he had the law
no.
of the money. Anyways, I have a copy here, but the figure becoming ground is a monster. It was on that page, and I think it said law of theorization.
Him,
what?
he talked about this to me when we were at the students' restaurant in St. Michael's, along with a journalist, a journalist who had been reporting on the IRA and on the problems in Northern Ireland. There was a time when it was still very, very hot. And Marshall was saying things like,
"The people wait till the cameras come." He talked about that in Dublin.
Yeah.
You know?
He said that. And all these people want to be heroes. And, of course, that's what's happening right now.
So when he says a piece of information acquires infinite mass, that's equals MC squared, is that the monster? A piece of information becoming the monster?
No, it wasn't. No, it was rather that the background of what I'm saying is that the background, the monster is the fear, the monster is the angst, the monster is whatever is going to hit us because of the merging of the background of our experience and the foreground. When suddenly the world's problems become actually more important than yours and you can't do anything about it.
Right. Now, he quoted from Joyce there. You're in a situation where every move is your next.
Every move is your next.
He quoted that. And that's from Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake. I can't remember which. But we're in a situation where every move is your next.
That's a very clever. That's a very funny. I had not remembered that.
Yeah.
Or maybe never saw it. Every move is your next. I think it's...
That's what everybody's getting ready to react in any way that's
true.
Required.
I know. The Chinese make fun of that.
Yes.
They say, you people are always living in the future. You can't live in the present. You know.
Okay, so here you are being informed, living in the global membrane, in the event, and other people, everybody else is there a reason to be detached? Is there a reason to turn off the media and not know about it, not follow it? You know, what's the ecology here?
Yes, and no. This is a very serious question. No, really.
Yes, it is.
And I don't know what's the ethical response to it. One could fear that overexposure creates a lack of interest and indifference. One can. Really? That was predicted too by Buñuel. Do you remember Buñuel's Tristana? I think it was Tristana.
Yes.
If not, it could be any one of Buñuel's films, really, but I can't remember anyway that scene. And it's Fernando Rey, who is a brilliant actor,
yes,
along with a gorgeous woman whose name I forget. They're walking in a street in Sevilla, and on the right, there's an explosion. And they don't even turn around to look at it. And then you say, wait a minute, this is kind of strange. And then on the left, another explosion, and they still walk by and talk to each other as if nothing was there. Now, that's very powerful. It's a very powerful scene. He was a very powerful filmmaker. Anyway, so that's one reason not...
Hey, Derek, let me respond to that. Let me tell you.
Okay.
Ian told me that if Bob and Carolyn were in San Francisco and it was an earthquake, they wouldn't even notice it. So that's very interesting to me personally about that. I'm going to check that out.
Speaking of earthquake, I've had one.
Oh, lately?
Yes, I was in Chile. I was in Valparaiso
where I was giving
a talk. No, but it was a long one. It wasn't big. It was 6 point something. It didn't break anything in Valparaiso. But what happened was that I was in bed, and the bed starts shaking. I thought, what the hell is going on? Is somebody there? Not at all. The thing went on for almost a minute. Now, that's very long for the experience. Well, by the middle of that minute, I realized it was an earthquake. And I can tell you, I wasn't feeling my best. It really is. It's a scary thing because you say, okay, you have this real wave, like rapid waves of shaking, and you're in bed. And then these rapid waves, you say, well, something is slipping. what happens when he slips out? You know? It was terrifying. Anyway.
And
no,
you've never had
true.
That before. That's the first time for you.
No, it was not my first earthquake, but it was certainly the longest. And my first earthquake was like, you know, you hardly knew that it happened. You'd be told, oh, yeah, all right, that was an earthquake kind of thing. This
okay.
one, no, there was no doubt it was an earthquake.
So you, as it was happening, you couldn't feel the bed. You're floating, sort of. Is that what you're saying? You're floating?
No, it was no. It wasn't that strong. What it was like... a very slow. Did you ever use these Chinese massage tools?
Yeah, we have a massage chair. We have a massage chair.
You have a massage chair. Well, imagine a rather slower one. Imagine slower and a little bit uneven, whereas the massage machine is very even. Slow and enough uneven for it to sound very, you know, organic kind of thing, real, not technical.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So what did you do? It stops. Do you lay in bed for a minute, or do you jump up and run somewhere? What did you do?
No, I didn't jump up and run to anywhere. When it stopped, I just stayed there, and then I heard people in the corridor of the hotel, and they were talking, and they were talking in Spanish, but I got it that somebody was saying, yeah, well, it's over. Yeah, we all go back to bed. And you said, well, I'm already there. I'm going to stay there.
Well, what about aftershocks, or is there a period before that happens?
No. The fear was, and I heard that the next day, was that, you know, when these things happen, the real problem is not buildings falling apart. They've kind of equipped for that. But although the hotel didn't seem like it at all. But what happens is that they are afraid of tsunami, because earthquake, however strong it is much worse when it's by the sea than if it's just in the center of the inland.
Right.
Because the earthquake, of course, does create a wave, and that wave goes somewhere, and of course, usually it's in the city.
Yeah.
So
they wait for that. So they wait for news on that.
They wait for news on that, and they're everywhere in Chile, and even I was in Easter Island. That's an interesting place. But anywhere in Chile, you have a route for, it's called the tsunami route, and you just can see it's like normal paneling.
Yeah.
So you just follow that route if the tsunami's on. But usually it's going uphill, obviously, because the tsunami is fast. But I was also at Easter Island. That was an experience too.
On the same trip?
Yep, because you see, I was going to Chile and I was invited. I took just 5 days more and went on to Easter Island because it's 4,000 kilometers away from the coastline.
Yeah.
It's actually 4,000 kilometers away from anywhere.
Yeah.
It's absolutely isolated. There's no islands in between. That's the most amazing thing. It's the Pacific forever. So anyway, so you have to go by plane. And I thought, well, how many times would I be going to Chile and have a chance to see Easter Island? So I just hopped on a plane and went to see Easter Island. And it was really quite an experience. It's a beautiful island. And the stories behind the statues are really interesting. And they're totally local. There's absolutely, you know, von Daniker had it wrong. There was no kind of Martian dropping a few. One of them is 28 meters high. So it does take some kind of thinking of how you move that around. But they would carve it. You see, they would carve these huge statues in the honor of the chief of the tribe. Because the chief of the tribe had to show his, you know, chutzpah, so to speak.
Mm.
And it was in his honor. And so these, all the success, there are several tribes on the island, and all the tribes were doing their own, called Maui, these mountains. Moai. And these Moai, every time that one tribe fought against another tribe, they'd get to the Moai and they would bring them down. So we saw like 400 Moai.
Right.
And most of them are brought down. And then a tsunami did happen to bring down whoever was still standing and throw them all over the place. So what a Japanese company paid for putting them back where they should be. So there is one place where you see 15 standing, but you see several places where they are standing.
Right.
And they go from any size. They go from, maybe 1 meter or, let's say, 5, 6, 7 feet at the most, and they go all the way to, you know, meters.
Right.
28 meters are like 60 feet. That's a lot of space.
Right. Now, they're not there to ward off invading people coming across the ocean?
Absolutely not. All of, and I'm glad for the question. All of them have their face turned inland. All
of them.
It's very interesting. When, you know, it really is. It's by the sea, most, but not all. Most of them are by the sea, but not necessarily. There are also some inland. So the sea did not necessarily count as a dominant thing. But it has nothing to do with frightening off enemies. Not at all. They have their back turned to the sea.
Well, that can still be intimidating.
Well, sure. No.
Right.
Sure.
Apply some McLuhan to this. Is this iconic resonance going on? Like, is there tactility in the structures, the relationships between them?
Everything is tactile by the fact that it's made of everything
stone.
Is tactile by the fact that it's made of volcanic molten lava.
Oh.
So it all has that very rugged, complex.
Yes.
It's not unified. There's very little unified stone there. In fact, there's very little stone except volcanic. It's a totally volcanic story, and it's very interesting. They explain how it happened and how it is bound to actually disappear. With the continental slip, there is a perfect line along which the island will continue being, and then eventually it will be under the sea, while another island will be born because of the huge continental fault is very close, and so that the moment it slips off, there will be more explosions. So anyway, that's one
okay,
of the
so
things.
That's a side thing. Let's go back to this serious question. Should one turn off the media, yourself personally, in engaging this, or, you know, what action is the media ecological appropriate gesture?
Well, as a man who's lived protected from the media most of my life, it's probably it's very important to answer this question with some sort of experience. It's most of the time I did not follow the news regularly, like not daily.
Yeah.
I would be very busy. I would be writing. I'd be working, and then I would wait to be on a plane, and then I'd read everything I could find on the plane. And there was a time when on planes you could actually find these things.
Yes.
And so I read Times and Newsweek and The Economist and all these magazines, which would give me the week kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that was so I always had a more or less a week between the time things had happened and at times I wasn't watching TV. I just didn't have time for TV.
Right.
So TV gives you the day, right?
Yes.
But I would feel that the compendium of news coming weekly was enough for me to feel informed, but at the same time not being committed, not a news junkie kind of thing.
Right, right.
Which of course I have become. Now I am a news junkie.
You mean this week or in general? You mean this week or in general?
No, in general. I have Le Monde and the Globe and Mail in my pocket, and I will go to them at least once, certainly once, and more like three or four times a day.
Wow.
So I have become a news junkie. I don't know whether it's a good thing or not. I'm just finding that I am much more attentive to the political and the social issues by being a junkie than I used to be.
And you're,
so in
you're,
that sense,
what are
would,
you consuming, TV, internet, when you're saying you're being a junkie? Which medium are you using?
I'm using mostly the newspaper. This is a bit of video, but not much. The newspaper version of the news. That
all right,
means,
so you're still, using the eye. You know, you would read these magazines on the plane. You're detached with
yeah.
the eye, and you're still doing the eye. You're still not watching
yes,
TV.
I know, but I'm not detached.
Well, that's
not only, you know, I'm not. I'm using my hand to navigate these things. So, you know, it's not just the eye.
Okay, I got an interesting point to make, Derek. We met shortly after 9/11, and you at St. Mike's the Diner, and you said you were at a loss of what to say because you felt you were going to be asked to comment in the media at some point. Maybe you already were asked, and you generally didn't know what to say, and we talked about that. Do you have that same anxiety now? If you were asked immediately by CBC to comment on this, would you have the same sort of suspended, you know, not knowing what position to take? right now in response to this?
No, I don't plan my positions. I am in those positions, and they, whatever comes out from those positions. So I wouldn't worry about that. No, I don't know that I would be. Look, I've been thinking of, look, the next issue of the Media Duemila is about jihadism. So it's not as if, you know, this is not something that I'm thinking about. I think a lot about it. And I would have a, I would have something to say. And I don't feel, no, I'm not, I think I am prepared to a certain extent. What I would want to talk about, which is what I feel very strongly, is the redistribution of war. It's a, the redistribution of the war location, war's effect.
Yeah, but how is this different from McLuhan saying in Take Today that World War III, the present war, this was in 1972, there was no division between civilian and military fronts. Is it different now from that?
That has been coming for a while. You know, I think it's a very important observation, but I don't think that it's original. I think it's been around for a while, that a lot of people have noticed this. My father was perfectly aware of how the war between Palestinians and Israel, for example, was a war of people and not a war of military. It was horrifying. He described me things which were absolutely god awful, and they make whatever's happening today perfectly coherent. The only thing is, today it's being done with rifles and, I mean, guns and Kalashnikovs and so on. In those days, mostly it was done with knife and you know, they love cutting. These guys, once they're at it, they love cutting bodies.
Right.
And so there was a lot going on in that way. So whereas they're mowing them down with a submachine gun is a new way of dealing with the problem.
Okay, so what's different from 1972 is that you have constant, you know, CNN types of coverage. You didn't have that in McLuhan's day.
No.
What else would be different about this situation? Everybody's equally informed all around the world. Everybody can respond and text about it, so that's different. That's a deeper involvement. Everybody's a broadcaster.
One of my mottos is, if you can respond, you're responsible.
Yeah, the ability to respond. That's what responsibility is.
That's what I'm saying. If you can respond, you are responsible. And that's something that is maybe distributed in the world today or may not. I don't know. I really don't know. I hope that this is going to be the case, but I have no evidence of it.
Okay. So McLuhan talked about that in the 60s. Because of the involvement of the Electric Global Theater at that time, he said, everything causes everything. Therefore, you can't make one person guilty for a crime. Everybody's guilty. Do you remember him saying that?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
No, but that's for sure. That's what I actually mean. But
so who's
you can
guilty
also
now?
Argue that one of the questions that would be interesting to explore here is whether the persistent attack in France, which is more than elsewhere, has to do with the fact that the French were colonizing all these people from North Africa.
Yes.
All the way from Tunisia to Morocco via Algeria, all the people who are actually coming are people who are taking revenge on the colonizing.
Yeah, that's the tribulation.
And up to a point, the tribal issue is a very McLuhan thing. That is in fact a response. The whole thing, whether it's Syria and the ISIS and so on, the whole thing is a kind of response of the colonized to the colonizers.
Right. It's in the Bible. Derek, in the Bible, it calls it the time of the tribulation. So there's the tribalization right there in the word.
Yeah. And this is the time of tribulation now.
Well, one could take that point. A lot of people do. They think the signs point to today. I mean, there's always someone saying, it's now. They did it in 57. They did it in 66. They did it in 75. You know, all these different religious groups thought it was the end times. But the electric, there is no time under electric conditions. There's no finish line. And that means there's no beginning.
Yeah, no,
we're
always
in the middle.
That's an interesting approach. Yes. No, well, that's for sure.
So you have this immense involvement that everybody can broadcast on it, but the humans want a centralized factor to bounce it off, so they want to have a central headquarters that's telling us something. Nobody's thinking of finding out for themselves what's going on. We go into a passive mode of retrieving center margin information, right? We're waiting for the headquarters to tell us.
Yeah, it's true. That is a situation. Well, it's a situation when there is danger, but it's not a situation. That's not the situation when there's no danger. Then we don't wait. We don't.
Right.
But right now there is danger. So
right.
That yes, we become dependent on the conditions of danger.
Now, what would be? I was telling you a couple of episodes we did that we're talking about educating young people, and I was saying we got to fully comprehensively educate young people to become warriors. Not in a paranoid sense, and I don't even know what I mean, but how are people to be stronger in relationship? What do they need to know now? What do they have to understand? Is everybody being cool? That's why it's quiet in Nice? Is that a desirable situation?
Oh, God, no. No, I think people are shocked. No, it's just, Nice is under shock. I think France is under shock. I think everybody's under shock.
Well,
that's
I'll tell
it
you.
It's shock.
I'm not following the media. I'm not doing anything. I'm not paying attention. So I wasn't in a state of shock today, right? Because I'm not paying attention to it. I will
eventually,
over the next 12 hours before I go to bed, I will look on the Drudge Report or something to tell me what's going on. But I have no desire to stay informed.
Well, you know, that's the other side of it. So, all right. So,
you're feeling very involved. I'm feeling not so involved. But partly I'm in Hawaii. I'm, quote, safe, right? You know, you talk about Easter Island being 4,000 miles from places. That's what Hawaii is, 2,500 miles from anywhere, China, North America, Alaska. We're, like, the farthest away. I didn't know Easter Island was 4,000 miles
away. That didn't prevent Pearl Harbor, but anyway, go ahead.
So I don't know if that affects me being out here. I don't even think about it. I'm here in a wonderful environment, and that's where I am. And I'm on the internet with my chip body, and that's involving personally. But I'm not going to follow what headquarters says about the news. I know it's not reliable.
No, and I understand the position. I do. I think that the ambience of news or place that we inhabit is a matter of selection. It's a matter of it's either good luck, good fortune, or a matter of how you actually plan to live. And so, if you get into it, and it's not all. I'm sorry. I just take it back. It's a matter of selection up to a point, and then something happens, and you are confronted with something that you had not taken into account before.
The effect. And I'm
how,
effect.
How do you deal with that? That's what it's in, that's what's interesting. And yes, it is the media that do it, but it's also the world that does it. So behind the media, there is something that's going on, and it's been going on. If it had been just once, I remember when these poor guys who were making drawings of Mahomet in Denmark were actually, you know, sent death threats and so on, and there wasn't anything done with them then. Then later it was, but not at the beginning. I remember, okay, that's ridiculous, and then went on with my business. And it never struck my mind again, but when the events, and the murderous events, started, you know, happening here and there and accumulating, I mean, the last time I kind of slipped over was when somebody set fire to a nightclub in Indonesia. But I don't remember, I don't know that it was related directly to any kind of terrorist act. It obviously was a terrorist act, but it was not related to what's happening today, not related to a very planned and very strong guidance in where to hit and how to hit.
Yeah.
But at that time, I slipped a bit over that one. But after Sydney, after Paris, in January, after Tunisia, and now this, and then they were, and the Canadian thing was less important, to a point the Canadian thing was sounded more like the effect of a madman.
Yeah.
And you don't feel quite as responsible. Yeah, that's what it is. You don't feel quite responsible for madness because you don't know how it works.
Yeah.
But for the situation that we are confronting now, yes, I am part of a culture that actually is responsible for it. We would not, had we not pushed these guys to this extreme, they wouldn't have this level of inflammation. It's not just them, and we have nothing to do with it. I think as a culture, even though we suffer from the very same people that everybody suffers, which is the money-hungry people and the guys who are investing and literally bleeding the world. But we are part of those who are bleeding the world, not them. And so there is a responsibility.
Yeah, you're not talking about the colonialism.
It's part of the background, part of that stress business that I'm talking about.
Right, but you're not talking about the colonialism. You're not talking about the
foreign. No, it's more, well, colonialism is actually now rampant. The system of the big capitalists, and I'm not Marxist and I'm not communist and none of that. I'm just saying the system as it works today is hugely exploitative.
Yeah.
Thank goodness some kind of transparency is look at as little and as ridiculous as what Volkswagen did. Or look at all the people, you know, stashing the money that they're actually stealing into bank accounts in Switzerland, which was not made by Swiss leaks.
Right.
Look at the Cayman Islands and where all the huge companies are actually evading taxes at the same time. This is just a small aspect of an attitude of greed and control that's global, and now it's coming through very strongly. And those people are saying, "Hey, we are given, you know, total absolution if we engage in the name of Allah in all the things that we're doing, and we'll become a hero on top." Hey, why would you hesitate? Of course not. You'd go right for it. And that's how they recruit people as well. They say,
yeah,
you know, they are treating you like shit. Well, you want to be somebody? Come and join us. And it's true. They are treated like shit.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody pays, you know, in France, people actually, you know, a bit like, it's like walking in Washington where racism, of course, doesn't really exist. Everybody's so sorry for everybody else. Everybody's so apologetic. You know, there's very much a code. No, there's a code. There's a code of behavior, which is, and I must say that for me, the election of Obama was a wonderful relief because finally somebody of one crowd is getting into the other crowd in a way that's very big.
Yeah.
But let's say that a certain polite order of things is keeping Washington down. Well, the same goes on in Paris, or the same goes on in the Quartier Arabe, and the same goes on in Nice, and the same goes on all over France. There is, you know, yes, some of them eventually hit a Fontainebleau school and become big guns. A lot of them get on the media and become big entertainers.
Yeah.
There is a genuine effort on the part of the French to become multicultural. It is. You can feel that it's, you know, I'm not talking about Marine Le Pen and all her crowd, but there is a sense that, yes, this country has been trying. But nevertheless, the kind of division, the instinctive division between the Muslim crowd and the Arab crowd and the Aryan crowd, it's still there. So the kids feel bad, especially the kids in these, you know, low housing communities, which are usually in the periphery of Paris and places like that. You know, there's been books and films made about how racism is really strong in those areas.
Yeah.
And the people are really made to feel bad. So, yes, we have a responsibility, not having been able to manage the way we deal with these cultures in various kind of situations. Okay, maybe it'll work out. Maybe something like Canada will appear elsewhere, because Canada has been not ideal, but a lot better in terms of racist issues than the many countries that I've been into. Maybe it's going to happen. And also, Canada is breathing now because of not having Harper on its back.
Mm.
But there is no doubt that we need to develop an entirely different social kind of dimension worldwide, because we're not going to get anywhere. this could be this. I consider that this is happening as a kind of. First of all, it's a religious war, like the one in the Renaissance. It really is. It's
Which
a global
Buffon predicted
war.
In the Maclean's magazine in January 81, or January 80, he predicted that. His final predictions, he just passed on. No, he just had a stroke. But he laid out the predictions for the 80s in January, an early issue of Maclean's, and he said, more and more religious wars and holy wars are coming. That's what he predicted. You know, everybody thinks he's talking about a pastoral global village. No, he wasn't.
And the interesting thing is we are like getting the sidelines of that war, because it's not between Catholics or Christians and Muslims, and nothing to do with that. It is between Shiites and Shia and Sunnis, and we are getting the sidelines, because in fact the real war that jihad is entertaining, and it's now developing also with Saudi Arabia and various. It's between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So Saudis are Sunnis, Iranians are Shiites, and they're at each other because of their religious war, which is something we're getting the offshoots of it.
Yeah.
So when I say that this is the religious wars that are, it's not yet anyway, and it may never. I don't know that it ever will come to, you know, the Muslims versus the Christians. I doubt it. I really do. But we are suffering from the excesses and the inflammations around that particular war that's going on today. Now, that's one aspect. And then the other aspect is that the acceleration, obviously, and the concatenation of all these various levels of culture and time and beliefs and so on, pushed all against each other by the media and by the sort of narrowing of the planet and the reduction of the, you know, of the, I would say, the reduction of silence and space.
Yeah, like
all of that.
It's the implosion.
Yes, it is. We're imploding, and the implosion is developing huge explosions of energies.
Yeah.
So there's no fusion yet.
Right. So bring in McLuhan's point that violence is a result of an identity quest. Is that a very old cliche way to look at what happened today? You know, is that
no,
useful?
I think it is. Well, it is. I mean, think about the motivation of these kids coming from France and rushing to Syria to fight with ISIS against Assad.
Right.
Well, these kids are looking for identity. They are absolutely looking for identity.
Yeah.
I am somebody. I will shoot and kill. And, of course, there's also all that mythology about, you know, how you become strong by the number of people you kill. Not kind of thing you and I share, but some cultures have that. And in fact, I remember the Dayaks have it. But in any case, no, the point of the identity crisis is very strong, but it's an identity crisis that relates to social values, not technological ones. It has to do with being lifted off the ground by the media. Yes, it does, but it has. But its real expression is against people. It's not, you know, it's an issue of how you are looked at, not only how you have lost your bearings.
Okay, so if an identity quest is a result of new environments that are threatening your old identity, and you have to forge a new one or retrieve the old one, and that's a violent quest. These young people, do they even have an identity that was scrapped? Are they beginning to look for a first identity just to get one?
Yeah. In many cases, they are buying an identity by getting into a religious ground as opposed to most of the educational system. Oh, what's happening?
No, I'm still here.
But I'm hearing a buzz, and I'm not quite sure why. It's probably because the phone is tired. Let me just put some light on and look at it.
Okay.
Yes, it's extremely unhappy. In any case, I'll tell you what. I have a bit of a problem in that I have a guest coming tonight, and I haven't done the shopping, so I have to go and do it.
So let's just talk for
another
minute.
I can come back.
Let's talk.
Huh?
What did you say? You could do it later?
Let's just take another 5 or 10, and then
we're just going to do a few more minutes. So let's try to make a big blinding insight here about this situation. So you were just saying the kids, they're embedding themselves in a religious emotion or something.
Yes, they're riding. Yeah, how would I put this?
You know, McLuhan said
They're writing. See, this is the bloody phone. It's very unhappy. They're riding a huge bandwagon. The
religious
one.
Now, McLuhan said in '68 in a dialogue with Norman Mailer and Malcolm Muggeridge that we were going into a great religious age. Okay.
Yes.
Was he imagining this kind of panic religion? Of
I think we were into it. That was too much. There was a flare of New Age into that. No. There was. He wasn't. I don't think so. I mean, maybe Marshall did, but I don't know that.
He did predict holy wars. 10 years later, he's talking about. That's interesting. He may not have meant some kind of New Age. Utopia.
Maybe, but he should have been clearer about it, because that's something which was easy for him to, clear off. He could have added something or said something around it. The context has never been clear.
Right.
It was never that. He did not ever say, well, I think, the Muslims are going to rise up against the Catholics or the Christians.
Right.
I don't think he ever had that in mind.
Do you know what he did say? And here's one that people don't know. He said in the late 60s that the blacks will be exterminated in the United States. He said that. And then he said, so I see the imprisonment of the blacks in ghettos and in the prison system is a kind of slow genocide. You could look at it that way.
Okay.
So he predicted it, but it wasn't an instant genocide. But there is an extermination that many black people, well, you see it in the students and black students now in America, right? They're really up in arms about this, these little acts of violence by the police. So whenever I encounter Cornel West or any of these people, I tell them what McLuhan said, and they're shocked. They don't know that he predicted that you would be exterminated, I say. And they don't know that McLuhan was aware of the violence that would come out of this situation. They think he was some pastoral hippie projection. You know what I mean? A global village.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, yeah. No. It's that was, that's definitely very strong.
So I say what we're witnessing is what McLuhan predicted. This violence that we're seeing.
No, of course, but we're always doing that.
Okay, but see, I'm saying that there is something else going on here. The kids, the running off of Syria or this and that is not what's going on. There's some other kind of warfare going on. I don't know if it's secret factions. Just to keep the military industries going, there's police, state security investment in this. There's a bit of a conspiracy going on with this. There's going to be a lot of people coming up with conspiracy information on this, right? We know that.
Yes.
But let's look, what is the factor no one's thinking about if you apply McLuhan's discarnate factor, and then you bring in my fact that we got five bodies now, five bodies warring, and there's no division between civilian and military fronts. Let's say there's no division between the bodies now, the chip body, the TV body, the chemical body, and the astral body.
Oh, no, but there's that convergence has been going on for a while. I mean, obviously these divisions are jumping, but then the new medley is looking for its own, it's looking for its equilibrium and its structure, and it hasn't found it. We don't
know
what
the conductor
is coming up.
It's looking for the satellite conductor. It's looking for the satellite conductor.
Yeah.
And your president there said, we are going to wipe out anybody who was involved with this. I mean, what else can he do? See, there's where there's a lack of detachment. He's not bringing up the fact that we're all responsible technologically. He wouldn't say what you said. And that's irresponsible, that the president does not talk in McLuhan terms about the situation. Are you still there? I think he's gone. I think his phone died. So I got the last word. So we will end right now, and thanks for listening. We'll continue soon.